This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Neurothera from Claire Labs. Your brain's complex metabolism requires many different nutrients for optimal performance. Neurothera is a broad-spectrum neuronutrition formula that supports the central nervous system and cognitive capacity. Used daily, Neurothera supports mental clarity and cognitive function. It provides the essential building blocks for optimal brain health. For more information and to purchase Neurothera, just go to my online dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, which is really one of my most fun occasions of the week. I hope it is for you because, well, you never know what you're going to hear. And it may be an issue that relates to you or to a loved one. Always, we mix it up with questions from you, our listening audience. Radio program at AOL.com is the destination for questions. We got quite a few questions this week. With me today is Layla Mudin, who is my usual partner in crime for this weekly podcast. She's our nutritionist in residence and capably assists us in answering these questions. So, how you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Great. Let's see what's in the news this week. Trying to see what piqued my interest. Anything on your end?
Oh, not really, except, you know, unfortunately, I'm still seeing these headlines of, fish oil may not be so great for heart disease, or vitamins aren't that helpful.
Well, you know, I did a video on that subject where we pushed back against that assertion. Mm-hmm. It was like somebody came, sort of rehashed all the arguments against supplements. The studies show they don't work, so they say, and the, you know, there's harm associated with supplements besides they're not regulated, and basically it all boils down to expensive urine. And so, you know, check out that video we've posted on Facebook. You can find it on my YouTube channel. And I think we kind of, you know, once again, damage control, we rose the occasion and pushed back on those assertions. I see here that yet another story about curing diseases in mice. We managed to cure wrinkles in mice, according to a new study. You know, how it was that they induced the wrinkles in mice. They gave them an antibiotic, tetracycline. And tetracycline, it turns out, has damaging effects on the mitochondria.
Yeah, and not great for teeth either.
Right. And so that's the way you damage your mitochondria, by taking tetracycline. And you can restore the mitochondria by stopping the tetracycline. And then, you know, the wrinkles go away and the mice's hair grew back in abundance. So again, once we have mice, you know, with spinal cord injuries, we're making them walk again. And, you know, and then we had another study, I think you sent me the results of that.
Yeah.
What was that again?
That a ketogenic diet may damage mitochondria further in mice with already damaged DNA or some thing like that.
You know, last time I checked, I mean, if you put a mouse in front of a plate of grain and then a plate with a steak on it, which do you think the mouse is going to go to first?
It's going to go for the grain.
I'm thinking the grain.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of hard to extrapolate to a human experience by putting a mouse on a ketogenic diet, which is primarily protein and fat.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just saying, you know, they're mammals and there's some similarities. And, you know, we like to use them because they're inexpensive. Mm-hmm. You know, they're a dime a dozen, you know, and they're the traditional subject of experiments.
We need to have human studies.
Yeah.
More than any, you know.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, that's really what needs to happen. So, and there are plenty of human studies on the ketogenic diet, on a low-carb diet. So just to look at this mouse study, I don't know how useful that is.
Again, another one of my rants. I ranted against mouse studies in a previous video. So let's tackle some of the questions that we have for this week.
Okay. We've got from Anna. Dr. Hoffman and Layla, thank you so much for your podcast. I've made a number of changes to my supplement routine since I've started listening to you.
Great.
So I just would like your thoughts on a few things. Do you think that iodine is really safe for the beneficial bacteria in our gut? Because, you know, we like iodine to support immune health and all of that. And she has a second question. I understand that a big reason that there's so much caution about iodine is that there's concern that high levels of iodine may harm the thyroid. From what I understand, this is mainly an issue for people with Hashimoto's. This is true. However, by taking so much iodine, will you start having a problem with your thyroid?
Right. So iodine, it's a controversial nutrient because pretty clearly we're getting less iodine than most folks got in a paleo diet, although it varied according to locality. There are certain parts of the world which were very low in iodine content, especially inland areas, and these became the so-called goiter belts of the world, where people had enlarged thyroids. That occurred in the American Midwest, in the area of around the Great Lakes in Minnesota. Around the coasts, people get seafood, which is a source of iodine, and seaweed, indeed, in Japan is a major source of iodine. The suggestion is we probably need more iodine than we're getting, although more people do have access to seafood. I mean, you can go to a restaurant in Kansas City and order, shrimp Newberg and lobster bisque.
Lobster Newberg, yes.
Lobster Newberg and...
and shrimp bisque.
And shrimp bisque, yeah.
Lobster bisque is good, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, we pretty much internationalized the food supply, and there is less localization of iodine deficiency. Iodine is necessary for production of thyroid hormone.
Yes.
It's a necessary cofactor.
For the thyroid, yes.
But there's a couple of contradictory phenomena that have been characterized with iodine supplementation. One is a phenomenon which causes hyperthyroidism with iodine. In other words, it may set off what's called thyroid storm. And that's called the Bazidow effect, after a guy named Bazidow, who was a German physiologist in the 19th century. And he noted that if you administer iodine to certain people, they will go into overdrive too much.
Wow.
On the other hand, there are some studies that suggest that too much iodine can also suppress the thyroid.
Ah.
And in fact, that principle is invoked sometimes in therapy to a slow Graves' disease or hyperthyroidism. You know, thyroid is administered. In this case, usually radioactive thyroid, but it turns out that thyroid will sometimes suppress an overactive thyroid. But it's a little risky to do that because you don't know whether the thyroid is going to go into overdrive or whether it's going to be suppressed when you use high-dose thyroid. So I'm a little cautious, although it's kind of in vogue to use high-dose thyroid therapy these days.
Dr. Brownstein,
yeah. Brownstein in Michigan is a big proponent of that. And you can, you know, we've also written some book, we've reviewed some books on the subject of iodine in the past.
I think a main reason for iodine deficiency in our country is the fluoridated water.
Right. These things in the periodic table are in the same row. They compete with one another.
Yeah.
So chlorine, fluoride, and bromine are all in that same halogen, I think, column along with iodine, if I'm not mistaken. And that's what interferes with iodine uptake.
Yeah. So making sure that you're not swallowing your fluoride toothpaste or, you know, filtering your water, although I don't know how much will remove the actual fluoride.
It depends on the filtering material.
I think
charcoal removes a fair amount. That's the simplest, cheapest kind of filter.
Yeah.
So the question is, will it affect the microbiome?
Yes.
And that's an interesting question because you know how in the old days when you fell and skinned your knee, you know, mom would apply iodine and you'd go, ouch, you know, it's painful, you know, it hurt.
Yes.
But, you know, that hurt was supposed to be therapeutic, you know, and the more it hurt, the better it was. So that was the theory in those days. And then they came up this painless thing. I remember when it was it was introduced called Bactine.
Oh, Bactine.
And it was like, oh, what a relief. I don't have to get
Bactine, the spray.
Yeah,
it was. I just remember the commercials.
Yeah.
That.
So then that seemed to replace iodine. Iodine is a wonderful disinfectant. So there's a good question is, does it affect the microbiome?
Yeah.
And indeed it might. Hmm. Indeed, high-dose iodine might affect the microbiome in some way. Mm-hmm. And prior to this podcast, I did a little homework on iodine effects on the microbiome, and I didn't really find a lot of research on that. So mm-hmm. maybe that's a subject for research, and maybe that's one of the ways in which iodine can be therapeutic. It might be for bacterial overgrowth, it might suppress harmful bacteria in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
It might
mm-hmm.
change the microbiome.
Yeah, interesting. I guess it would be good advice to take a probiotic as well.
But if you're taking iodine. One thing that iodine is really good for is...
Just take a probiotic anyway, whether you're taking iodine or not.
Iodine is great for fibrocystic...
breast disease.
Painful breasts.
Yeah.
Not just cystic breasts, but the pain
yes.
associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
Some women have very painful breasts. It's sometimes mm-hmm. hard for them to lie on their chest, and that can be alleviated with iodine mm-hmm. very nicely.
Mm-hmm. So iodine is also implicated, or the lack of iodine is implicated in possibly breast reproductive cancers,
yeah.
prostate.
Right. I do prescribe iodine for women who are recovering from breast cancer, mm-hmm. As a preventive, because
yes.
it's actually been shown to be not just prevents painful breasts, but it may have something to do with cancer prevention.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff, Anna. We hope you are helped by that answer. Thank you for your question.
It's time to allow one of our sponsors to share this important message with you. So please support our sponsors, all of them, because they're what make Intelligent Medicine a free resource to you. Here goes. Listen up. Your brain's complex metabolism requires many different nutrients for optimum performance. Excessive release of adrenaline and cortisol, plus environmental exposures and oxygenation, may be impacting your alertness, memory, and other vital functions. This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman with a broad-spectrum neuronutrition formula that supports the central nervous system and cognitive capacity. It's NeuroThera from Claire Labs. NeuroThera provides balanced neuronutrition. Used daily, NeuroThera supports mental clarity and cognitive function. It promotes blood, oxygen, and glucose delivery to the brain and helps protect against oxidative stress and inflammation. NeuroThera provides the essential building blocks for optimal brain health. I believe in NeuroThera so much that I've included it in the Intelligent Medicine Brain Health Protocol. For more information and to purchase NeuroThera, just go to my online dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. And now, back to our questions. What's next, Layla?
Here's a question from Ingrid. I've read conflicting information about natural antifungals, things that you would take for SIBO, like berberine, oregano.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you take it for a long term, can it be taken long term, or is it, again, destroying our good bacteria? A lot of microbiota questions.
Right.
Today.
So let's look at that proposition. These days, it's in vogue to take an antibiotic for SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. It's called
yeah.
Xifaxan. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
These days, we've been trying to get a source for our patients in Canada, which is equivalent and much cheaper. But the problem is that it will temporarily alleviate the symptoms of SIBO, but you can't take it forever, A, because of the expense, and B, because the bacteria will acquire resistance and then overgrow.
Mm-hmm.
So the nice thing about these botanicals is that they work in a multiplicity of ways. They're not just laser-like in their antibacterial effect.
Yeah.
Usually the antibiotics work in have a single mechanism of action to inhibit bacterial growth or kill bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And the botanicals are generally gentler,
mm-hmm.
and they have a multiplicity of actions to suppress the bacteria, plus they are often used in combination.
Yeah.
So what they do is they're sort of like, they'll give your flora kind of a haircut,
mm-hmm.
but they won't completely sterilize your GI tract. It's almost impossible to do that with botanicals.
Uh-huh.
They will inhibit the bacteria to some extent, mm-hmm. but won't, they'll selectively eliminate the pathogenic species, hopefully, and yeah. allow the beneficial species mm-hmm. to survive.
Yeah.
That at least is a theory. But, you know, look, berberine has a side effect. It has a side effect of constipation for some people.
It can, yes.
Yeah, so what it does is that it so thoroughly pares down the bacteria that, you know, bacteria are about a third of the weight of your stool.
Yes.
And, you know, what's left is the other, you know, waste material. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that bacteria make up some of the composition of your stool, you may have harder stool mm-hmm. Sometimes with berberine.
Yeah.
Also, it's an astringent a bit of, so it has a drying effect on the intestine.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's one of the effects of that.
Mm-hmm. A very astringent food, like something like berberine or black tea, mm-hmm. which is also kind of astringent, very tannic.
Tannic.
That can also mm-hmm. dry you up. This is often a cause for constipation for many people. Where, mm-hmm. Well, I drink several cups of black tea a day, English breakfast, Earl Grey, mm-hmm. something like that.
Even chamomile.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Chamomile has a bit of a constipating effect.
Okay. And oregano is a wonderful antifungal.
Mm-hmm.
If you use oregano in your cooking, oregano is wonderful for candida.
It's actually been said that if you, one of the big problems in hospitals is staph infections, and mm-hmm. because they're running out of antibiotics that are actually going to treat the staph, it's very resistant staph, yeah. That they actually came up with a proposal to aerosolize oregano in hospital rooms. It has kind of a nice pizza smell.
It's like, where's the marinara?
Yeah, right. It's harder for the bacteria to require resistance to it because of the many compounds mm-hmm. in oregano. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful disinfectant. And we actually use a product called oregacillin sometimes to emphasize its antibacterial properties.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful for lung health too. Nature's Pharmacy, once again. Okay. Thank you, Ingrid. All right. Oh, this is a very interesting question. Don't have a name here. I have a question regarding my 68-year-old sister who has rheumatoid arthritis. Her body temperature is in the 96-degree range. Mm-hmm. She's had 2 shivering cases in the summer when it was very hot. She sleeps with no air conditioning, has tons of blankets on her, even when it's very hot and humid. It scares me because this can't be normal.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like an underactive thyroid.
Yeah. I think that's a no-brainer. I think there's really strong likelihood of that mm-hmm. in this person. Although, you know, it's overly simplistic to say that anyone who experiences cold intolerance has hypothyroidism. It may be a sign of there's a multiplicity of ways in which the metabolism can be slow, and thyroid is the major governor of sort of thermogenesis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is like fat burning mm-hmm. to create body heat. Mm-hmm. And so that would be, you know, a first thought in this person.
So they need a workup.
And, you know, there is this thing, phenomenon where sick people have more resistance to thyroid. It's like insulin resistance, but it's resistant to their thyroid hormone. And sometimes they have seemingly normal thyroid profiles, but if you dig a little deeper, you'll see reverse T3 being high, mm-hmm. or their total T3, which is the active thyroid. Mm-hmm. There's not enough of that. It's T4 is normal, but the conversion from T4 to T3 is hampered by the illness.
Or maybe the medication she's taking for the rheumatoid arthritis.
Even that is possible, yeah.
That's interesting. It's also possible that this person, because she already has one autoimmune disease, rheumatoid arthritis, that she may have another having
Hashimoto's.
To do with thyroid.
Sure.
So
there's a higher...
That's something to get checked out. Mm-hmm. That demands a visit to the doctor.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
We can't fix it on a podcast. We can point an erection of a fix.
Thank you for your question. Best of luck to your sister.
Almost as good as a trip to the doctor's office.
Yeah.
But not quite.
Ah, here's another. And again, I don't have a name here. A question for your show. What do you suggest for axonal neuropathy pain relief and healing? The only thing found abnormal was vitamin B6. The serum level was three times.
So let me just say something about that.
Yeah.
There was a guy at my medical school who, while I was in medical school, did some studies on neuropathy and vitamin B6. And I think his name was Schomburg or something like that. He was at Einstein when I was there. And so this is like the late 70s, early 80s. And so what ended up happening is, in those days, a popular therapy for PMS was to take a lot of B6.
Yeah.
So he actually found a few cases of women who took very high doses of B6, maybe like 500 or 1,000 of B6, and they created neuropathy with the B6. So he popularized the idea that B6 could cause neuropathy. And incidentally, B6 is a treatment for a certain type of neuropathy, which is carpal tunnel syndrome.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe there was something to that, that too much B6 could be toxic. And it was actually the first time that B6 toxicity was demonstrated. And they actually had balance problems as well. You know, so there's like, they get issues. So from then on, it has made many neurologists suspect of B6. And so what they do is, if you have neuropathy, they'll often test you for B6. Usually they don't care. They don't test you for B6. But if you have neuropathy, they'll check you for B6 to see if you have this rare B6 neuropathy. And what they'll invariably find, if you're taking any kind of multiple or B complex, is you've got too much B6, because of the way that they measure the B6, It really is the range that they've created is much too low.
Okay.
And so virtually everyone who I've seen who takes a vitamin has, according to those tests, too much. So right away they go, it's those vitamins that are causing your neuropathy.
Right.
When many of these conditions are what are called idiopathic. We have no idea how they arise.
Yeah.
And then they tell you, stop taking your B6.
Mm-hmm.
So in my opinion, it's not the B6 that's causing the problem. It may not be helping the problem, but it's probably not causing the problem, because you're going to show high levels of B6 if you take B6. So what do you do for axonal neuropathy? Well, not all neuropathies are the same, but in certain neuropathies, things that help are alpha-lipoic acid, especially diabetic neuropathy. And the doses are sometimes up to 3,000, I've seen in some studies, but, you know, a safer, cheaper regimen is like 1,200 a day of alpha-lipoic acid. And then acetyl-L-carnitine, 1,000 to 2,000 of that a day. Those are the main things that are traditionally helpful. And sometimes B12 shots, even if your B12 is normal, you can go like kind of supercharge your B12. And then you will see two high levels of B12, but it's okay because you're using it therapeutically.
Right.
So in other words, let's say you take lithium for bipolar disease, and you measure your lithium, and of course your lithium levels are going to be many, many, many times normal. But you're using a therapeutic dose of lithium. You're like like a normal person, a very low lithium in their blood.
What about thiamin, like in
Benfotiamine might be helpful for certain types of neuropathy. Mostly studies have been done in diabetic neuropathy, but you know, part of the problem with things like axonal neuropathy is it's a form of neuropathy where, you know, as a non-neurologist, I'm not going to, you know, distinguish it among the many subtypes.
Yeah.
But it's the axons are the nerve sheaths. And so it is a form of peripheral neuropathy. In other words, as opposed to like some sort of brain or central neuropathy.
Okay.
I mean, you know, for instance, we saw a patient today with CIDP, chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy, which is, you know, a different subtype. So the other thing is just generally anti-inflammatory things. There might be a place for, since the nerves are affected, things that support myelin, like omega-3 fatty acids, possibly things like borage oil to fluidize the membranes. Phosphatidylcholine has been used in some treatments. You know, maybe also NT factor, because it works on cell membranes and mitochondrial membranes. maybe something like NAD support with nicotinamide riboside.
Yes,
that might be helpful
riboside.
For something like that.
Mm-hmm.
What I was going to say is, since axonal neuropathy is a rare condition, there's not a lot of literature on what works for that condition.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, diabetic neuropathy is so common that there are studies, but, you know, you don't see that many patients with axonal neuropathy.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have studies saying, oh, it turns out that alpha-lipoic acid is the bomb for this, that is
yeah.
like a real fix. So
okay.
that's, we're sort of mm-hmm. applying the lessons of other forms of neuropathy to a different condition where, you know, it may or may not.
Mm-hmm. This person
help.
Is awaiting a genetic neuropathy panel.
Okay.
At
so
this time, so
whatever
maybe
that is,
will reveal.
There's some highfalutin
yeah.
test that shows there's some genetic flaw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe there's some methylation flaw. That's one of the genetic
mm-hmm.
things that turn up on some tests.
That could be okay.
Which would then argue for more B vitamins.
Ah.
Not, you know,
yeah.
folate, B6, B12.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Steve. Okay, I just found his name on this email, all the way at the top of the page. Thank you, Steve. We hope you feel better soon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, you know, I think with neuropathies, we got to also consider toxicities. You know,
yeah.
like
mercury,
lead,
arsenic,
and cadmium, but also the possibility of some sort of chemical exposure.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. Wow.
Take a good occupational history.
Yeah.
Maybe look at blood levels for some
yeah.
of these chemicals.
Chemotherapies.
Absolutely. Chemotherapy
cause
absolutely. And you know what's interesting about chemo is that these days, the taxanes are drugs that Taxol
okay.
has a reputation for causing these. Also, some of the platinum-derived chemos.
Cisplatin.
Carboplatin, cisplatin, have been associated with neuropathy quite a lot. And a very high percentage of, especially women for gynecological cancers, get these therapies, ovarian cancer and uterine cancer. And so we've had a few patients these days where we have treated them
mm-hmm.
Preventively so that they don't get neuropathy. And we're like 0-for-6 on these patients
yeah.
because they've not had neuropathy after very harsh chemo. And statistically, we would say that maybe 40-60% of them would develop some loss of sensation, especially in their fingers
yeah.
and dexterity.
Yeah.
And then none of them have had that. And so we've given them B12 shots. We've given them alpha-lipoic acid, acetyl-L-carnitine.
Mm-hmm.
Glutamine also has some protective effects against that. I wouldn't necessarily say it's going to fix axonal neuropathy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know.
Okay.
But as a preventive
yes.
against those things in chemo, and those things will generally not interfere with most chemos.
Yeah. Fascinating. Okay. All right.
Well, we're reaching the midway point of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Our listeners know that we divide our podcast into two parts, so please be patient. Flip the your LP over to side two. And, oh, wait a minute. We're in 2018, so we don't do that anymore. So just advance to part two. And in part two, what are we going to take up?
Are there any supplements that I could take or a diet that I should follow to help slow the symptoms of Parkinson's disease?
Boy, are there.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll tackle that in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman today with Layla Mudin, our nutritionist in residence. Radio program at AOL.com is the destination for questions for a weekly Q&A with Layla. We'll be right back.